Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 37, East of the Euphrates. Last episode, we looked at the Christological controversy around the Bishop of Antioch, Paul of Samosata. This episode, we journey further east, heading out from Roman Syria, and looking at the early Church of the East in Mesopotamia and Persia. Before proceeding, a brief note on terminology. The title Church of the East is the most common designation in the scholarly literature for the ancient Christian communion east of the Euphrates River. This title is no doubt confusing, as haven't we already been talking about the Eastern Church? That is, the Greek-speaking Christians of the Eastern Mediterranean, in contrast to their Latin brethren in the West. Obviously, the terms East and West are somewhat relative. A Christian living in, say, Antioch would no doubt see the Church of Rome as Western, but a Christian living in Persia would call both the churches of Rome and Antioch Western. The Church of the East and its modern-day successors have many other names just to make things more confusing. The Assyrian, East Syrian, Chaldean, Nestorian, and Persian Church, to name the most prominent. It is not our purpose here to delve into the intricacies of all these names and the different communions which have adopted them. For now, I shall refer to the Christians of the Great Church in the Persian Empire in these ways. Assyrian, that is, the indigenous Semitic Syriac-speaking inhabitants of the land of Assyria, which is basically the far eastern part of modern Syria and northern Iraq. Examples of such persons include the legendary King Abgar of Edessa, whom we discussed way back in episode 6. Note, of course, not all members of the Church of the East were Assyrians. Many also came from other regions of the Persian Empire, and even as far afield as India. East Syrian will also be used in reference both geographically to the Assyrian heartland, but more specifically, the liturgical rite of the Church of the East. Finally, the term Persian Church will also be used, when necessary, to distinguish these Christians from the Greek-speaking Christians of the Eastern Roman Empire. However, more than any of these, I shall stick to convention and use the term Church of the East whenever possible. With that out of the way, let us proceed on with the narrative. Given the very different political history of the non-Roman Near East in antiquity, I think it is important to give a brief overview of this history so we can orient ourselves to the world the Church of the East came about in. For a slightly fuller overview, see episode 91 of Mike Duncan's The History of Rome. The First Persian Empire, or Achaemenid Empire, was founded by the famous Cyrus the Great in the 6th century BC. The famous Persian King of Kings who freed the Jews from the Babylonian exile. The Old Testament books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther find their provenance and historical setting in the era of the Achaemenid Empire. It was also this same Persian Empire, under kings such as Darius and Xerxes, which came into conflict with the city-states of classical Greece, including Athens and Sparta, resulting in famous battles such as Marathon, Thermopylae, and Salamis. Eventually, in the latter part of the 4th century BC, the Greeks got the revenge on Persia under the leadership of the Macedonian conqueror king, Alexander the Great. But shortly after his conquest of the Achaemenid Empire, Alexander died, ushering in a period of chaos and political turmoil as his generals fought each other over the pieces of his empire. As we saw back in episode 22, Egypt was claimed by the Macedonian general Ptolemy, whose descendants ruled the Nile kingdom until Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra in 30 BC. Much of the old Persian Empire, including Greater Iran and Mesopotamia, came under the control of the Seleucid dynasty based in Antioch. It was under the rule of the Greco-Macedonian Seleucids that the Old Testament books of the Maccabees are set, when the Jewish Hasmonean dynasty managed to throw off Greek rule and establish an independent kingdom of Judea. This Jewish dynasty persisted until the Romans allowed Herod the Great to take the Judean throne in 37 BC, thus setting the stage for the early life of Christ. The Seleucids, for their part, maintained effective control over the old Persian territories for some time. But in the late 3rd century BC, one of their satrapies, Parthia, rebelled under the Arsacid dynasty, leading to a series of wars which lasted over a century, until the Parthians had claimed all of Greater Iran and Mesopotamia. The Seleucids were reduced to a rump state in Syria, and lingered on until Julius Caesar's frenemy, Pompey the Great, annexed Syria into the Roman Republic in 63 BC. From there on, Rome and Parthia competed in the Near East as the two dominant empires of the region, spending much blood and treasure for control and influence over the border kingdoms, such as Abgar's Assyrian kingdom of Osroene, and most especially, the ludicrously important kingdom of Armenia in the Caucasus. This was the stage into which Christianity first spread to the lands of modern Iraq and Iran. The early history of the Church of the East is shrouded in legend. Traditionally, the apostolic founders of the church were the Apostle Thomas, the Apostle Thaddeus / Addai, his disciple Mari, and Mari's disciple Agai. The historicity of their legends and what historical kernel lies behind them is all but impossible to determine. Some of the scholars I have read think that it is certainly possible, though not provable, that Thaddeus and the others evangelized the East. Other scholars contend that the legends are wholesale inventions designed to boost the prestige of the Church of the East in later centuries. What we can say is that the gospel came to Mesopotamia and Iran primarily from the Christians of Edessa and Osroene. Christians like Tatian's Encratites, Palat's Catholics, and the followers of Bardazin. In addition to the Edessene church, Luke does mention in the Acts of the Apostles chapter 2 that during Pentecost there were Jews from the lands of Parthia, Media, Elam, and Mesopotamia. These earliest converts to Christianity were in the city of Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. After the festivities had ended, they returned home to their native land and brought their new Messianic faith with them. No doubt, Christianity found fertile grounds for evangelism among the Jewish diaspora within the Parthian Empire. Babylonia, especially, had long been home to a vibrant Jewish community going back to the Babylonian exile in the 6th century BC. The Jews had thrived under Cyrus the Great and many of his successors, and they continued to do so under the Parthians and later the Persian Sassanids. More on them in a bit. All in stark contrast to the rocky relationship the Jews had with first the Greeks and then the Romans. The Babylonian Jews were led by a Davidic exilarch, who acted as a representative on behalf of his people to the Parthian and Persian governments. It would be the Jews of Babylonia who would create the most important literary text of Rabbinic Judaism, the Babylonian Talmud. This strong Jewish community was especially protective of its minority status, however. And as we shall later see, would at times collaborate with the government against rival faiths, like Christianity, in order to guard its position. Despite this, however, Babylonia would become the eventual heartland of the Church of the East. Another region of the diaspora that proved fruitful for evangelism was Adiabene and its capital Arbela, modern-day Erbil in Iraq. Other regions like Elam and settlements like the great fortress city Nisibis would also become major centers for the Church of the East, with prominent bishoprics. Christianity also spread over the Zargos Mountains and into greater Iran and beyond. By the early 3rd century, there were already Christian communities in the Persian heartland of Fars, and even as far afield as Hindu Kush and Kerala in India. I've posted a map up on the blog site to help you with the geography. The vast majority of Christians east of the Euphrates were native Syriac-speaking denizens of the Parthian and Sassanid empires. We have encountered Syriac-speaking Christians sporadically in our narrative, including King Abgar, Tatian, the wayward disciple of Justin Martyr, and Bardasan of Edessa and his followers. Nevertheless, a significant amount of Greek-speaking Roman Christians also lived in Mesopotamia. Some of these Christians had fled east to escape Roman persecution, while others were refugees deported by the Persians during their wars with Rome, as we saw with Demetrian of Antioch. These East Roman Christians did not usually integrate with the Syriac Christian communities, but instead formed their own bishoprics and retained independent parishes drawn along ethnic and linguistic lines. As such, the early organization of the Great Church in the Near East was often disorganized, with multiple bishops in a single city. In addition, unlike certain episcopal sees in the Roman West, such as Rome, Carthage, and Alexandria, no single bishopric held any sort of seniority, let alone primacy, among the bishops of the Church of the East. Certain cities no doubt had prestige, such as Edessa and Nisibis, but by and large, the early Church of the East was decentralized and lacked an obvious center. Bishops acted with near total independence within their respective areas. This therefore made it difficult for the church to represent itself to the Persian rulers. It also made it difficult to keep the ecclesiastical hierarchy accountable and allow the church to speak on matters of importance with a unified voice. The need for the Church of the East to speak with a unified voice became ever more important from the year 224 onward. For in that year, the Parthians, who had ruled for some four centuries, were overthrown. The Parthians were not native to Persia, but were outsiders from Central Asia. Their empire, when united, was a match for the Roman Empire in the East. But the Parthian kingdom was a decentralized, feudal-like monarchy. In contradistinction from the Roman emperor, the Parthian King of Kings was theoretically in charge of various sub-kings, whose domains made up the territory of the empire. This all changed in the early 3rd century, when the Parthians were vanquished, and a new native Persian dynasty assumed power, creating a centralized autocratic empire which proved to be the greatest foreign power the Roman Empire had ever faced since the days of Hannibal. I am talking, of course, about the Sassanids. For Mike Duncan's introduction of them in the history of Rome, see episode 105. The Sassanids, or Sasanians, were an Iranian family who originated from the region of Fars, the Persian homeland. The name Sassanid originated from the name Sasan. In my research, the identity of Sasan has yielded two different, although not mutually exclusive, answers. The more familiar one to listeners of the history of Rome is that Sasan was the grandfather of the first Sassanid king, who began the family's rise to power in Fars some decades earlier. The other explanation is that Sasan was a patron Iranian deity from whom the Sassanid kings claimed descent. Whatever the case may be, the Sassanids would come to rule the lands they called Iranshar and Aniran, that is, Greater Iran, the land at the center of the cosmic order, and the non-Iranians who were part of Iranshar. This first Sassanid king of kings was Ardashir, who began his war against the Parthian Arsacids in the early 220s. Ardashir's revolt came to a climax on April 28, 224, when he defeated the last Parthian king, Artabanus V, in battle. With that, the Parthian Empire came to an end. Its decentralized feudal structure replaced with the now centralized autocracy of the Sassanids, who established Iranshar as a new superpower and set to work on challenging Rome for control of the Near East. Although successful in his wars against Rome, Ardashir was surpassed by the truly spectacular successes of his son, Shapur I. It was Shapur whose invasion of Roman Syria resulted in the 253 sack of Antioch, possibly carrying off the bishop Demetrian into exile. It was also Shapur who defeated and captured the persecuting emperor Valerian in 260. I'll stop here because the details of the many Roman-Sassanid wars have been well covered in The History of Rome and successor Robin Pearson's The History of Byzantium. In relevance to our narrative, religion became ever more important under the new Persian Empire. Whether or not they were descended from a god called Sasan, there was no doubt in the minds of the Sassanid kings which religion was true and good. Zoroastrianism. It is not our purpose here to cover the entire history and theology of Zoroastrianism, a faith which still exists today. While we shall cover the basics of ancient Zoroastrianism, our focus will mainly be on the Zoroastrianism of the Sassanid era, as that is the form of Zoroastrianism which has the most relevance to our story. Reconstructing the history of Zoroastrianism is fraught with extreme difficulty given how hard it is to date the material in the historical record. Much of what we do have comes from the period of medieval Islamic Persia, and so to what extent it can be relied upon to reconstruct the Iranian religion in its ancient form is hard to determine. The name Zoroastrianism is derived from its eponymous founder prophet, Zoroaster, or more accurately, Zarathustra. The historical Zoroaster is shrouded in uncertainty, and even the time period he lived in is still disputed by modern scholars. Some opt for an earlier date of around 1700 BC, way back in Bronze Age Persia, while others argue for a much later date of the 7th and 6th centuries BC, closer in time to the Median and Achaemenid empires. Whatever the case may be, the Iranian prophet is himself only of marginal importance for Sassanid Zoroastrianism. The real focus of the religion was not on its founder, but on its god, Ahura Mazda, also called Ormazd, or simply Mazda. In fact, the centrality of Ahura Mazda in Sassanid Zoroastrianism is so great that some scholars prefer to refer to the religion as simply Mazdaism. At its heart, the cosmology and mythos of Zoroastrianism is one of optimistic dualism. In eternity past, the good god Ahura Mazda, the wise lord, creates the universe, including good spiritual beings. But he was opposed by his evil counterpart, Ahriman, or Angra Mainyu. As a result, Ahura Mazda's omnipotence becomes temporarily limited. And so, the wise lord creates the physical world, including the elements, plants, animals, and humanity, as part of a grand plan to defeat Ahriman and his evil spirits. When space and time come to an end after 12,000 years, Ahriman will finally be defeated, and the rule of Ahura Mazda will be established forever. Human beings are part of this battle between the good god and the evil god, and must make the moral choice to follow one or the other, which invariably weighs on their life in the next world. Because the physical world and life itself were created for a moral purpose by Ahura Mazda, it was considered the sacred duty of Zoroastrians to participate in life-sustaining work. This included not only good behavior, like not lying, which Zoroaster himself detested, but also attending to nature by engaging in agricultural pursuits, partaking of the fruits of the earth. This also meant getting married and having children, as this was also participating in Ahura Mazda's work of sustaining life. In addition to all this, worship of the sun, fire, and even water, as the principal elements of Ahura Mazda's world, were also important parts of the Iranian religion. So much so, that fire temples became the signature Zoroastrian holy place in the ancient world. There is much here that parallels Judaism and Christianity. A big good and a big bad, Mazda slash Yahweh and Ahriman slash Satan or Belial, with spiritual and human servants under them, battling in a cosmic conflict for the fate of the universe. The importance of moral choices in this life is also quite similar. As a result, many scholars have tried to discern to what extent Zoroastrianism and early Second Temple Judaism influenced each other in the days of the Achaemenid Empire, and to what extent the Abrahamic religions influenced Zoroastrianism as it later developed in the late Antique and Islamic periods. Despite these similarities, however, Christians and Zoroastrians would find themselves opposed to one another on a variety of issues. The early church also believed the physical world and human life was a good thing created by God. In opposition to Gnosticism, the church taught that the physical was created by a good God and that the physical creation, including the human body, needed salvation. But unlike Zoroastrianism, the church believed the physical was fallen and that human nature had in some way been corrupted. Thus, while the body was created good, it was corrupted by sin, and so Christians had to often struggle against the body with forms of asceticism, like abstaining from food and sex. While marriage and the rearing of children was viewed as good, Christians also believed that the celibate life was also pleasing to God. In fact, many believed the ascetic life was actually the higher and rarer calling. In contrast, asceticism and its later expression, monasticism, had no place for Zoroastrians, who saw it as completely contrary to the moral duty of human beings to participate in Ahura Mazda's creation. The worship of the sun and elements was naturally an area where Christians and Zoroastrians also conflicted. They could both agree that creation was inherently good, as Zoroaster had taught and as the church had inherited from Second Temple Judaism. But worshiping creation? That was completely unacceptable to the early Christians, who also inherited from Second Temple Judaism an uncompromising monolatry. Only the Most High God should receive worship. The one area where Christians and Zoroastrians really did share a commonality unique to them was structure. Just as the church was united in a college of bishops across the world, with subordinate presbyters and deacons, Sasanid Zoroastrianism was made up of an organized hierarchy of priests, mobeds to the Persians, more commonly known to us by the Hellenized term magi or magians. At the top of this hierarchy was the chief priest or priest of priests, just as the Sha'an Shah or king of kings was at the top of the political hierarchy. The state and religion of Iran Shah were intertwined and depended on one another. The kings needed the priests to support their rule as the will of Ahura Mazda, and the priests needed the kings to protect and enforce the good religion. And yes, I do mean enforce, because if there was one thing the Magi did not accept, it was apostasy. Especially apostasy to another religion which taught things antithetical to the will of Ahura Mazda, and espoused teachings that could be associated with Ahriman. The Church of the East would in time endear its fair share of persecution by the Zoroastrian state. Ironically enough, the first of these Persian imperial persecutions began as an attack on a rival heretical religion related to Christianity. In the early 3rd century, an Arsacid couple living in Babylonia joined the Judaizing Christian sect of the Alcaziites, followers of Elxai. We'd mentioned this group briefly back in episode 27 as one of the heretical groups Origen of Alexandria confronted in Roman Arabia. Not long after they joined the sect, the couple had a son who was born on April 14th, 216 AD. At the age of 12, the boy began receiving visions which he claimed were from his heavenly twin, whom he believed to be the Paraclete promised by Jesus in the Gospel of John chapter 14. The boy began to protest against the practices of the Alcaziites and tried to promote a more Gnostic religiosity. At the age of 24, this young man received new visions from his twin, which directed him to leave the sect and found a new worldwide and universal religion. This man's name was Mani, more commonly known as Manichaeus, the founder of Manichaeism. Manichaeism was once one of the great religions of the ancient and medieval worlds, stretching from the western provinces of Rome all the way to China in the Far East. The religion was essentially a form of Gnosticism which syncretized Christian, especially Marcionite Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian, and even Buddhist concepts into a universal faith. The Manichaean mythos is far too complex and long to spell out here. Mani put even the great Gnostic heresiarchs and Greek mythographers to shame when it came to the sheer complexity of his myth. Bottom line, it was a Gnostic cosmos. The spiritual world of light was good, and the physical world of matter was evil. And human beings needed secret knowledge to escape the prison of the world to come to the light. If you want the full details, I recommend Chapter 11 of Berger Pearson's book, Ancient Gnosticism, which we discussed back in Episode 11 when we first introduced Gnosticism into our narrative. Mani and his disciples traveled far and wide across the Near East, and even into India, where Mani converted a local king and was exposed to Buddhist ideas. Mani saw himself as the current incarnation of the Apostle of Light, whose previous incarnations included Buddha, Zoroaster, and Jesus the Messiah. Jesus himself in Manichaeism is a rather curious thing, because he plays multiple roles. He is Jesus the Splendor, one of the Manichaean aeons who helps awaken Adam to the secret knowledge of salvation. He is also the suffering Jesus, personifying the trapped living soul in the evil material world. As the Messiah, he is an incarnation of the Apostle of Light and will return as judge at the end of the world, after the Great War when darkness and matter are defeated. Christologically, Manichaeism was strongly docetic. Jesus had no physical body whatsoever, only appearing so, as matter was evil. When Manichaean missionaries reached the Roman Empire in the 270s, they desired to show the Orthodox Christians the falsehood of believing in Jesus' physical body and true humanity. In a similar vein, they also argued that Christians needed to reject the earthly and fleshly Old Testament as sacred scripture, a la Marcion. Mani was a prolific author and artist. He strongly believed that as the last incarnation of the Apostle of Light, his teachings were the final revelations from the Father. As such, he made sure to carefully record his religion in writing, as well as crafting several illustrations to help depict his teachings. To top it all off, he even developed his own canon of sacred Manichaean scripture. In many ways, the Manichaean religion was ahead of the curve when compared to the church. In addition, like other Gnostic sects, Manichaean adherents fell into two groups, the elect and the hearers, who supported the elect. At the head of the elect was the prime leader, the successor to Mani, and under him was a hierarchy of other elect leaders. Thus, Manichaeism, like the Christian Church and Sassanid Zoroastrianism, adopted a hierarchical priestly structure. Mani at first developed good relations with the Sassanid court of Ctesiphon. He delivered an address to Shapur and was a friend of his son and successor Hormizd. But the growing strength of the Manichaean religion ran into a powerful enemy in the form of Kurdir, the Zoroastrian high priest. In February of 274, the Persian king Bahram tried and imprisoned Mani. On February 26, 274, Mani was finally crucified and died. His death subsequently became a greatly celebrated annual feast of the Manichaean community. Following their prophet's death, the Manichaeans were subjected to a general persecution by the Persian government. It should be of no surprise to us that Kurdir and his Magian colleagues now at the height of their power, found it prudent to persecute Mani and his followers. The new religion contradicted the basic tenets of Zoroastrianism, such as the goodness of the physical world, the need to participate in the earthly world as opposed to asceticism, and the moral purpose of creation, just to name a few. Curdir and the Magi were able to expand religious persecution during the reign of Bahram's son and successor, also named Bahram. The persecutions eventually included several religious groups, which Curdir proudly immortalized in an inscription from circa 285. Curdir celebrates how he has defended Zoroastrianism by striking down Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, Manichaeans, Nazarenes, and Christians. The use of the terms Nazarenes and Christians seems to refer to Syriac-speaking Christians and Greek-speaking Roman Christians, respectively. Curdir was able to accomplish this in part because the King of Kings was initially unable to distinguish between Manichaeans and Christians on account of the similarities between the faiths. Understandable, given the syncretic and Judeo-Christian origins of Mani's religion. As a result, it soon became apparent to many among the Church of the East that they needed to be able to represent themselves before the Sassanid court in a unified way. Thus, not long after the persecution of Bahram II, the first bishop of Seleucia Ctesiphon, the Persian capital, was consecrated sometime in the 280s. His name was Papa Bar Gagai, and it is with him that the Church of the East finally begins to emerge more solidly within the historical record. Similar to how Demetrius of Alexandria's episcopacy marks the emergence of the Great Church in Egypt. As bishop of the Persian capital, Papa asserted claims of primacy over the other bishops of the Church of the East. Bitter controversy erupted almost immediately, with whole bishoprics rising up in revolt against what they perceived as Papa's gross abuse of episcopal power. The conflict came to a head in 315 at a council in Ctesiphon. After a heated exchange, the following agreements were reached. 1. Papa would be succeeded by his deacon Simon Bar Saba, who had opposed Papa's claims and had been an important figure in the resistance faction. 2. Papa's claims of primacy were rejected, but his position as bishop of the Persian capital was acknowledged tentatively as giving him the nominal position of leading bishop of the Church of the East. From then on, the bishops of Seleucia Ctesiphon would rise in power, and their position as head of the Persian church would be solidified over the next century. Papa himself died either in 326 or 329. With that, we shall leave the Church of the East for now, in the early 4th century, under the leadership of Simon Bar Saba. Next episode, we return to the Roman East as we explore the origins of Christian monasticism, and in particular, the life of the so-called first monk, Antony of Egypt. As always, thank you for listening. Don't forget to send in your questions and requests to historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com for our upcoming Narrative Break episode series once we reach the end of the century. We'll be covering everything from the Bible to theology to the church's relationship with non-Christians in the first 3 centuries. You may ask me just about anything related to the show, and I'll try to incorporate your questions into my research or include them in the Q&A episode at the end. Also, please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.